KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The suspect in the killing of two Israeli embassy employees is charged with murder. He once had ties to a far-left political group. Pro-left militancy has gone up since the war in Gaza. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. We're in Minneapolis taking in how things have changed in the 5 years since George Floyd was killed. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez, the mayor of Minneapolis, talks about improving relationships between the community and police. Also, former FBI Director James Comey has written a new crime thriller. He speaks with Leila Fadel about the controversy related to his recent Instagram post. It's Friday, May 23rd. 25 years ago today, Eminem released the Marshall Mathers LP, the fastest selling album in the history of rap. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is again threatening to impose new tariffs. Writing online, he threatened to impose steep levies on goods from the European Union, as well as on Apple for making iPhones overseas. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
President Trump wrote that trade discussions with the EU were going nowhere. He added that therefore, quote, I am recommending a straight 50% tariff on the European Union starting on June 1st, 2025. As the president has previously imposed tariffs via executive actions, it is unclear what he meant when he said he was recommending new tariffs. In early April, Trump announced 20% tariffs on EU goods as part of a wave of higher tariffs on most countries. He later pulled those back, and the EU rate currently stands at 10%. Trump, in a separate post, said that he has told Apple CEO Tim Cook that iPhones have to be manufactured in the United States. If not, Trump added, Apple would have to pay a tariff of 25%. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
Harvard University has sued the Trump administration for a second time. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports this comes a day after the Department of Homeland Security said it would block international students from attending the university.
In the lawsuit, the university accused the Trump administration of retaliating against Harvard for exercising its First Amendment rights. The lawsuit follows a letter sent Thursday by Kristi Noem, the Secretary of Homeland Security. In it, she says the administration is terminating Harvard's student exchange certification, which means the school can no longer sponsor student visas, impacting new students and currently enrolled international students. Noem says the administration is holding Harvard accountable for, quote, fostering violence, anti-Semitism, and coordinating with the Chinese Communist Party. The university has nearly 7,000 international students, roughly one-fourth of the student body. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
Ukraine says the first stage of a massive prisoner exchange is underway. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says nearly 400 Ukrainian troops held by Russia have been exchanged today and more are coming. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Ukraine where families of captured troops are holding out hope.
At the request of Ukrainian authorities, who cite security reasons, NPR is not disclosing the location where the families are waiting. Katya Kovel weeps as she holds a banner emblazoned with an image of her husband, Grigory, a soldier.
He has been in the captivity since December 7th, 2023. I hope he will be exchanged today.
1,000 Ukrainian POWs are expected to come home if the exchange happens as planned. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 324 points. The NASDAQ is down more than 200 points. This is NPR. Democrats in Congress are introducing a bill that would shift control of the U.S. Marshals Service from the Justice Department to the federal courts. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports there's concern the marshals could be caught in a power struggle.
Congressman Eric Swalwell of California worries the Trump administration could order the Marshals Service not to enforce a court order or remove security protection from judges who ruled against the White House. That's why he and other Democrats in Congress are trying to move the Marshals Service out of the chain of command at the Justice Department and under the wing of Chief Justice John Roberts and the policymaking body of the federal courts. This year, judges have faced violent threats and calls for impeachment because they've ruled against President Trump and the DOGE team remaking the government. The courts have asked for an increase in security funding to help confront those threats. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Sesame Street rock star Kermit the Frog was a commencement speaker yesterday. As one of the original Muppets, he spoke at the University of Maryland College Park's graduation ceremony. Kermit made sure to give life advice.
The show must go on. And if you're with your people, then you won't have to do it alone. Because life is not a solo act. No, it's not. It's a big, messy, delightful ensemble piece. Especially when you're with your people.
This was kind of a homecoming for Kermit the Frog. His creator was the late Jim Henson. He graduated from Maryland in 1960. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin at Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, Minnesota. Good morning. The man suspected of killing two Israeli embassy employees outside a Jewish museum in Washington, D.C., has been charged with two counts of murder, among other crimes.
Law enforcement officials say they're continuing to investigate the attack as a possible hate crime.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden is with us now with the latest. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
I understand that we now have a lot more information on what exactly happened. So what can you tell us?
Yes, we know now from the affidavit that the suspect, Elias Rodriguez, flew from his home in Chicago to Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. That's the day before the attack. He declared a firearm in his checked luggage, and he bought a ticket to the event that was taking place at this Jewish museum 3 hours before it started. It was a mixer for young diplomats. From witness interviews and surveillance video, we also have some pretty gruesome details of the shooting. Law enforcement officials say Rodriguez shot at the two victims from the back and kept firing repeatedly, even as one of them tried to crawl away. He then discarded his 9mm handgun, and eventually he went inside the museum and told a police officer that he had done this, saying, quote, "I did it for Palestine. I did it for Gaza."
And the Washington Post is also reporting that the gunman sat down indoors after the shooting as though he was fleeing the danger. A witness told the Post that somebody even got him a glass of water. So President Trump and others have called this an act of anti-Semitism, but is it correct that so far he has not been charged with a hate crime?
That's right. Not at this point, but Jeanine Pirro, the interim U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, told reporters that the murder charges and others are only the beginning. Federal agents raided Rodriguez's home in Chicago yesterday. They learned that he expressed admiration for a person who self-immolated in front of the Israeli embassy here in D.C. last year. He described them as a martyr. And Pirro says investigators are going through massive amounts of evidence to learn what motivated him.
Violence against anyone based on their religion is an act of cowardice. It is not an act of a hero. It is the kind of case that we will vigorously pursue.
And she says, look, there's going to be additional charges as the evidence warrants.
Tell us more about the two people who were killed. They were a young couple. They both worked at the Israeli embassy. What else can you tell us about them?
It's really quite sad, Michelle. Israel's ambassador to the U.S. said Yaron Lezhinsky had bought an engagement ring. He was planning to propose to Sarah Milgram next week. They were going to be on a trip to Jerusalem. Lezhinsky was a German and Israeli citizen. Milgram was American. She grew up in a Kansas City suburb. A friend of Milgram's, Israeli attorney Ayelet Rezin Bedor, told me she took the embassy job after Hamas attacked Israel a year and a half ago. She was already sensing a rise in anti-Semitism, and she wanted to combat that.
Not with violence or shoutings or verbal abuse, but in diplomacy, with love, with intelligence.
Rezin Bedor says it is a painful irony that Milgram lost her life in this way.
Finally, Jennifer, very briefly, obviously something like this heightens people's fears, obviously for many Jewish people, but others as well. Are officials saying something about that?
Absolutely. D.C.'s police chief says there's going to be more law enforcement officers around faith-based groups, schools, and places like the Jewish Community Center here.
That is NPR's Jennifer Ledden. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
We're now going to hear about more possible motives for the man suspected of killing Israeli embassy aides in Washington. Now, among the details still emerging about the suspect is that he once belonged to a far-left political group. Let's bring in NPR's domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef. So what's known so far about the suspect's political beliefs?
Well, someone with the same name as the suspect was quoted back in October of 2017 in a publication put out by the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and it quoted this person as being from that group. Since the killings, the PSL issued a statement disavowing the attack and saying that Elias Rodriguez's association with the group ended in 2017. I think, you know, we may learn more about this as the case develops. But also, yesterday morning, I went to the building where the suspect is believed to live. It's a brick multi-unit on a leafy residential side street in northwest Chicago. The windows of the unit believed to be his had a lot of signs up, three of them relating to the conflict in Gaza, one that said ceasefire now, another that included the message free Palestine. There were also signs for local politicians on the left, including a Democratic Socialist.
Now, we know that political violence has been on the rise in the United States, but how much of that are we seeing from the far left?
Well, look, the data show that the far right has been responsible for most of the lethal political violence we've seen in the last four decades. But I spoke with Colin Clark about this. He says he's been warning about a rise in far left militancy for years and says it's a reaction to the rise in far right extremist activity. He's with the Sufan group.
Only really since October 7th, the war in Gaza and the Israeli military campaign in the Middle East, have we seen this kind of uptick in what I would call far left militancy, far left extremism surrounding the issue of Gaza, and not just, you know, pro-Palestinian, but actually pro-Hamas, pro-Hezbollah, pro-actual terrorist organizations.
And Clark is, you know, says he's talking about a very small number of people doing that, but still, you know, he points to college campuses where there were some people waving flags of those organizations or voicing solidarity explicitly with them. Historically, far left violence has mostly been property damage. You know, we've seen this with the vandalism of Tesla vehicles and some of the riots during the summer of the racial justice protests in 2020. Lately, though, there have also been high profile events like attempted assassinations of Trump, the killing of a healthcare CEO, where the facts are muddy, but nonetheless, there is a perception that these were leftist actors. This attack, though, may be a clear case of lethality from the left.
Oh, okay. That's terrible to hear. What happens now? Where do things go from here?
You know, Clark says this should prompt some soul searching on the left. You know, it's tough to claim a moral high ground when someone commits an act like this. And, you know, you heard from Jennifer just now that some of the details in court documents paint a really chilling picture of these particular killings. I think it'll be important to watch also how this develops, both in the political arena and in public discourse. Will this suspect be lionized by parts of the public? And politically, there are concerns that the government may use this as a reason for significant countermeasures aimed at suppressing free speech and even pushing the boundaries of labeling certain groups domestic terrorists.
All right, that's NPR's Odette Youssef. Odette, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In a 6-3 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court said President Trump can fire two members of independent agencies for now.
Yeah, it's not the final say on the matter, but it is an indication of how the Supreme Court views the extent of Trump's power.
NPR's Andrea Hsu is here to explain. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning.
Could you just start by telling us who are these officials that Trump fired?
Yeah, so Gwen Wilcox was a member of the National Labor Relations Board, and Kathy Harris sat on the Merit Systems Protection Board. That's the board that hears federal employee complaints. And they both sued, saying Trump did not have the authority to fire them. In fact, in creating their agencies, Congress wrote into law that members can only be fired for cause, like neglect of duty or malfeasance. But the Trump administration has been arguing that those restrictions on the president violate the Constitution. So that's the fight that's been playing out in the lower courts.
And what have the lower courts said?
Well, there's already been a lot of ping-ponging back and forth, Michelle. Initially, two judges found Wilcox and Harris's firings not only violated the law, but also ignored Supreme Court precedent, a case called Humphrey's Executor from 90 years ago. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Congress could limit the president's power to remove members of independent agencies. And so Wilcox and Harris actually went back to work for a while. But the government appealed, there was some back and forth, and last month, Chief Justice John Roberts stepped in and allowed Trump to remove Wilcox and Harris again.
And now the entire Supreme Court has weighed in.
Yeah, yesterday a majority of justices said they think Trump does have the authority to fire Wilcox and Harris, for now anyway. They wrote that the Constitution gives the president the power to fire at will those officials who help him carry out his duties, with only narrow exceptions. And they said Wilcox and Harris probably don't qualify for those exceptions.
Okay, so tell me more about this probably. Does that mean that this is not necessarily a definitive ruling?
That's right. It's a stay while the appeals court weighs the merits of the case. To be clear, the Supreme Court hasn't yet heard arguments of this case. This order came out of what's known as the emergency docket, which conservatives have increasingly relied on to get quick decisions without a hearing. And this is something that liberal Justice Elena Kagan brought up in her dissent. She wrote, "Our emergency docket, while fit for some things, should not be used to overrule or revise existing law," meaning Humphrey's Executor. She said, "What's at stake here is not just someone's job, it's this very idea that Congress embraced when it created independent agencies, that, you know, if their members are insulated from political pressure, that they will make sound judgments that benefit the public good." Now, in recent years, the court has been chipping away at this idea and at Humphrey's Executor, but in yesterday's decision, the conservative majority did carve out an exception for one independent agency, the Federal Reserve.
Okay, so what did they say about the Fed?
Well, Wilcox and Harris had warned that if the court finds that Trump can fire them, that nothing can stop him from firing Fed Chair Jerome Powell. And in fact, Trump did threaten to fire Powell, which tanked the markets. Later, he pulled back and said he had no intention of firing Powell. In any event, the conservative majority disagreed with the notion that their order would affect the Fed. They wrote that the Fed is a uniquely structured quasi-private entity with a distinct historical tradition. Kagan scoffed at this in her dissent, and she maintained that the Fed's independence rests on the same foundation as other independent agencies. Now, again, yesterday's order is not the final word, but it does give us a pretty good sense of how the justices could rule if, and more likely when, they hear arguments in this case.
That is NPR's Andrea Hsu. Andrea, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face.
The music for the Broadway hits Bye Bye Birdie, Annie, and Applause was written by composer Charles Strauss. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with him. He also wrote the theme music for Norman Lear's sitcom All in the Family. Join us.
Pick out a pleasant outlook, stick out that noble chin. Wipe off that bullet.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Former FBI Director James Comey is back in the news as an author and as the subject of a federal investigation over a social media post. Comey's latest book is FDR Drive. At the heart of this crime novel are two questions. What is free speech? And what happens when someone's words incite violence? The book is fiction, but those two questions are front and center to the political climate right now in the United States. James Comey joins me now to discuss his new book and the government's ongoing probe into the meaning of a now-deleted personal Instagram post. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
If you could just briefly describe the plot of this novel.
It's about a right-wing podcaster who is trying to motivate his followers to engage in acts of violence against the targets of his vitriol. And it's about my protagonist, Nora Carlton, a federal prosecutor in Manhattan, trying to figure out how do we stop the violence, and is there a way to hold this podcaster criminally accountable for what he clearly knows he's doing? And that's the trick, because the line between speech and crime is, it should be clear, but it's fuzzy.
What brought the creation of this case in your mind that deals with something we've been reporting a lot on, this line between free speech and violent incitement and domestic terrorism, ideologically motivated violence?
It bubbled up from my having to grapple with that very issue throughout my career. I saw the growth of this domestic, homegrown, white supremacy-focused violence, and I thought, I know this is an issue for the FBI in investigating these cases. I know this is a key dimension of the threat. I think I could do a cool story that would grip readers using that as the center of it.
Frankly, in the book, there's this theme about how men are more likely to be radicalized when they feel as if they are under some sort of siege. And you write that it's a message that has worked for all of human history. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, speaking as a man, we, especially in maybe before our prefrontal cortex is fully developed, are susceptible to messages that touch our aspiration to be superfigures, to be dominant, masculine, centered, respected people. And those many people who don't feel that, who feel disaffected, disrespected, are, especially men, are susceptible to messages that come at them and promise them a center, a source of meaning, and an affirmation of your masculine role as an important figure in life.
Why did you choose to write female characters as the ones really beating this back?
I tried to write with a mini-me as the protagonist, and I really struggled with that. My oldest child is a federal prosecutor in Manhattan and a woman, and once I switched to writing through her, it unlocked something for me, and it became really a labor of love for me.
Did you have your daughter read any bits as you developed the character?
Oh, yes. In fact, all five of my kids and my wife are indispensable parts of my writing. They read and draft and give me feedback. Yep.
That's great. Is that ever contentious?
Well, yeah, no. The line they've drawn is, Dad, you cannot write sex scenes. So I don't want to disappoint my readers. There's lots of excitement in these books, but there is no sex.
Oh, my God, that is so funny. Also, I wonder if the American public is ready for a former FBI director to write sex scenes.
Yeah, the former FBI director is not ready, so don't worry about it. You're never going to have to wrestle with that question.
So a few days ago, you posted a picture on Instagram of seashells spelling out the numbers 8647. You've since deleted the photo, as the number 86 can be interpreted as slang for to eject, dismiss, or remove something that originated in the restaurant business. The post quickly drew the ire of the Trump administration and his supporters, accusing you of calling for his assassination. You have the head of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, saying you should be in jail. And they're saying you've called for the assassination, 86, the 47th president. Is that what you were doing?
No, not even remotely. We were walking on the beach and saw an arrangement of numbers, as you said, in seashells, and stopped trying to figure out what it was. And it was Patrice who first said what you said. She first thought it was an address. And then as we stared at it, I said, I think it's a political message. And she said, I remember from, she worked for many years as a server growing up. That's a term from the restaurant industry. And so it was she who suggested I take the picture. I thought, that's great. I took a picture and posted it because I thought it was a clever political thing. Never occurred to me that someone would try to say it was associated with violence. I actually still don't see that, but I took it down because I don't want, I mean, it's my Instagram account, for God's sakes. I don't want anything on there to be associated with violence, even if I don't get it.
But it has prompted an interview by the Secret Service about the matter. I mean, where does this investigation stand? And are you worried that you could be prosecuted for it?
Yeah, I'm not worried because there's no world in which this is an actual threat. And I understand why the Secret Service, given all that public leadership was saying in the Trump administration, had to conduct an investigation, or at least, I don't know whether they formally opened an investigation, but had to interview me. Happy to do the interview. Happy to explain, just as I did to you, with you, how this came about.
This is an administration that has been very vocal about wanting to go after perceived political enemies for anyone that they see as a threat. I mean, is this part of it?
I'm sure. I mean, I, for reasons I cannot explain, I seem to be the relationship that Donald Trump just can't get over. I mean, I've been gone from the FBI job for more than 8 years, but he still wakes up some nights, I guess, with pain in his chest that I'm gone, and I resurface in some of his posts. I guess maybe that'll happen forever, but it's just something I've gotten used to, and I try not to let it throw me off or distract me.
Do you regret the post?
Sure, I regret it in the sense that it became a distraction. I don't regret it in the sense that I had any sense that it was related to violence. As I said, I still don't see that, and still have always understood 86 as the way you said, or actually when I was a kid, 86 meant, let's get out of here. Again, I regret it in the sense that it's caused me to have to talk about seashells, but otherwise, no.
James Comey's new crime thriller is FDR Drive. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your book.
Thanks. It's great to talk with you.
This is NPR News.
It's been 5 years since a Minneapolis police officer murdered George Floyd.
This looks like we're still stuck in a rut. We're not doing anything to try to fix some of the issues. I don't see that being a good thing, especially 5 years later.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How the community of South Minneapolis is reckoning with its past and future on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Harvard University is now suing the Trump administration over a ban that it says has thrown the campus into disarray just days before graduation. The Department of Homeland Security is blocking the school's ability to enroll international students until Harvard produces a trove of records on its foreign student body by next week. In a lawsuit filed today in federal court in Boston, Harvard accuses the government of violating its constitutional rights. It writes, quote, without its international students, Harvard is not Harvard. Russia and Ukraine say a major prisoner exchange is underway, the swap involving hundreds of people on each side. It's one of the few signs of progress since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Mourners holding vigil across from the White House day after two Israeli embassy staffers were gunned down outside of the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington. Jennifer Mizrahi was among those who paid tribute last night to Yaron Lushinsky and the woman he had planned to propose to, Sarah Milgram.
Sarah was so empathetic and talking about how the people in Israel are suffering, the Palestinians in Israel are suffering. And she cared about this so much.
A 31-year-old Illinois man was arrested, and while detained, he yelled repeatedly, "Free Palestine." The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 267 points at 41,591. It's NPR. The American Reproductive Center, destroyed by a car bomb in Palm Springs, California, Saturday, is expected to reopen in a temporary location next Tuesday. Palm Springs Mayor Ron DeHart says the city council will also look to help the community.
This will allow businesses and property owners to be eligible for significantly reduced building permit fees, planning application fees, and potentially business license fees.
The 25-year-old suspect in the attack was killed in the blast. About 300 miners are trapped underground at a gold mine in South Africa, a union has said. Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg reports a rescue's underway.
South Africa's National Union of Mine Workers said they'd received reports the miners were trapped underground at the gold mine near Johannesburg on Thursday night. A spokesperson for the company that operates the mine, Siyabane Stillwater, told Reuters news agency the miners were unharmed and being provided with food. The company said preparations were underway to begin to hoist them to the surface. Mining is a major industry in South Africa, which has some of the world's biggest gold deposits. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Norwegian authorities are trying to figure out how a cargo ship ran aground along the Trondheim Fjord coast. It had almost crashed into Johan Helberg's home yesterday. Helberg told Norwegian broadcaster NRK that he slept through the whole thing and only found out about it when a neighbor rang his doorbell. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in St. Paul, Minnesota. Good morning. Yesterday, we took a drive over the Mississippi River to Minneapolis to visit City Hall and Mayor Jacob Frey. I asked what he thinks has changed in the 5 years since George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer.
Right now, we are very focused on not just getting back to the old normal, but blowing by the old normal and seeing true transformation in our city. George Floyd's murder was 100 years in the making, reckoning around racial justice. And in Minneapolis, of course, we felt it very acutely. We recognize and we own that we are the city where George Floyd was murdered. And we're also the city that's going to get this right. We're going to be the example for so many others to follow in the way that we do police reform. And by the way, we're making huge strides. And we're going to do everything possible to make sure that the precision of our solutions now match the precision of the harm that was initially inflicted.
When you first ran for mayor back in, I guess it would have been 2017, improving relationships between the community and the police was one of your signature issues. How do you think that's going, and what measure, what metric do you use to assess that?
We're making real progress.
How do you assess that?
Well, we don't assess it directly. We have an independent evaluator that assesses it. Of course, we've got our own internal audits, but look, you don't need to take my word for it. Look at what the independent evaluator said, that we have made greater strides over these years than any other city in the country under a consent decree.
You mentioned the consent decree. The Department of Justice announced that it wants to withdraw from the consent decree. And the current police chief, Brian O'Hara, said that basically what you both said is, all city leadership said, you're going to do this anyway.
That's right.
The question I have is, doesn't that send a mixed message? And if it does, how do you reinforce the message that you want to send?
The message that we are sending, every one of us are sending, is consistent, which is we're doing this anyway. The Trump administration, they can go in whatever direction they want. We are doing this work anyway. Whether or not the White House cares about police reform, we do here in the city of Minneapolis. And every single sentence of every single paragraph of that 169-page agreement, we're going to work towards compliance with. People have been demanding change for years, and we're not backing away from this agreement simply because Donald Trump is backing away himself.
There are people who still argue that the change is taking too long. For example, implementing public safety measures that don't rely solely on policing to respond to sort of different situations. I mean, this is a situation that we see like all over the country, really, in lots of places where people are having, say, a mental health crisis or, you know, utilizing other methods like, you know, violence interrupters. I mean, the argument is that these initiatives are just taking too long to get up and running. What do you say to that?
In Minneapolis, we've set those initiatives up. We haven't just talked about having mental health responders. We have them available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 5 years ago, we talked about wanting to have a response that didn't just involve an officer with a gun. Sometimes it's a mental health responder. And like I said, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we now have a mental health response when we call 911. And I'll just be real with you. It's not easy to build out, because what are the metrics that you use to track how they're doing? What specifically are they responding to, and how do they do so safely? Because you can't just send anybody into a circumstance that might be dangerous or violent. This is the
is
stuff
it harder
that we're
than you
working.
Thought it was going to be?
I don't know that we entirely knew what to expect, because it was brand new. And anytime you do something that is brand new, I think it's important for people to be honest. We got to be honest about where it's working. We got to be honest about where it's not. And then you make changes to make sure you're doing everything possible to have a successful program.
What do you think is the biggest takeaway from your experience these past few years? If you were to speak to your fellow city leaders around the country, what would you say?
First off, none of the work is easy. It's about changing culture and changing systems. It's 100 years worth of culture that's baked into the walls of City Hall that is hard to shift. Anybody who hasn't learned a few lessons in 2020 is probably not doing the necessary self-reflection.
How do you want the events of May of 2020 to be remembered?
We need to move forward. We shouldn't move on in the sense that we're forgetting what happened. You got to remember it. You got to acknowledge it. And you got to work like crazy to bend intentionally that arc of justice. And we got a whole lot of people that are working collectively to bend it.
Mayor Jacob Frey, thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you so much for having me.
Nearly a dozen witnesses testified about Sean Diddy Combs in the second week of testimony of his federal trial. The music mogul faces federal charges, including racketeering and sex trafficking. He has pleaded not guilty. Cassie Ventura, who was at the center of the prosecution's case against Combs, spent much of last week on the witness stand, and the details are disturbing. She testified that Combs beat her, forced her into sex acts, and generally controlled nearly every aspect of her life. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has been in the New York courthouse since the trial began. Listening to this week to nearly a dozen witnesses, who testified and what do they share, Isabella?
Yeah, this week we heard from several people who largely supported Cassie Ventura's version of events. So yesterday, the musician Scott Mescadi, who records as Kid Cudi, testified about his brief relationship with Ventura. He said they dated in 2011, which was in the middle of Ventura and Combs's decade-long on-and-off relationship. Mescadi said after Combs found out he was dating Ventura, someone broke into his house, and later, his car was set on fire in his driveway. Mescadi believed Combs was behind both of these incidents, although the hip-hop mogul and his attorneys deny that. Another witness was Dawn Richard, a singer who was signed to Combs' label and recorded music with him. She said she saw Combs punching, kicking, and dragging Ventura by the hair.
Yeah, pretty shocking allegations. The thing is, though, Combs is not being charged with trespassing or domestic violence. So how does their testimony tie into the charges?
You're right. And that's actually a point the defense has made again and again, because they admit that Combs is violent, but this isn't a domestic violence case. So these witnesses serve a few purposes for the government's case. One, they're there to show that Combs was allegedly not only threatening Cassie Ventura, but also the people around her. So it theoretically helps the government's narrative that Ventura feared for her safety and that Combs could have leveraged this fear to get her to comply with whatever he wanted, hence that sex trafficking by coercion charge. There was another witness this week, Ventura's mom, who testified that Combs was so mad she was dating Mescadi that he demanded $20,000. So Ventura's mom said she had to take out a home equity loan to get the money, which was ultimately returned to her account. Combs' attorneys did not deny that this happened, and they chose not to cross-examine Regina Ventura. But in their cross-examination of other witnesses close to Ventura, like her former best friend, the defense honed in on the fact that Combs and Ventura's relationship had a lot of ups and downs, but they really loved each other, and the defense is suggesting that's why she stayed with him for as long as she did.
All right, so what happens now, and how long is this trial expected to last?
We have about 6 weeks to go in the trial, so we're still going to hear from a few more witnesses, and then the defense is going to make its case.
All right, that's NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
This is NPR News.
I'm Asma Khalid. 5 years after George Floyd was murdered, we reconnect with one young activist from Minnesota about what hope looks like now. That's next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. Graduates of the University of Maryland received their diplomas yesterday, but not before hearing from their commencement speaker.
You're all here to listen to a frog in a very tiny cap and gown.
Not just any frog, that's Kermit the Frog, who was created by Jim Henson, a Maryland grad. Kermit honored Henson in his speech, who he said, quote, had a hand in everything I did. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Jens Ludwig is an economist at the University of Chicago, and for years, he's been obsessed with one of America's most intractable problems, gun violence. Our colleague Adrian Ma over at The Indicator has more.
For a long time, Jens Ludwig says the conventional wisdom we've been told about gun violence has followed this predictable pattern.
Both the left and the right share the view that gun violence is sort of premeditated and deliberate.
But when Jens and his colleagues at the University of Chicago began gathering data on shootings in the city, a different picture emerged.
Most of these shootings are basically like they start with words. They're arguments that escalate and end in tragedy because someone's got a gun.
The events that led to most of these shootings were not carefully planned by mass shooters. They weren't the stuff of TV drama. Often, Yen says the causes are just a lot more mundane.
Guy gets off the train, walking down the street, accidentally steps on another guy's sneaker.
And here is where Yen says a big aha moment came. It's a behavioral economics problem. And one of the big insights from behavioral economics is that when people are put in extremely high-stress situations, we often do not think rationally.
I really have come to think of gun violence as like normal human frailty that we all experience in moments of high stress.
If a huge cause of gun violence is just our common human frailty, what can we do about that? I know some of you are saying, what about gun control? If you reduce the number of guns, you reduce gun violence. Well, Yen says, hypothetically, sure.
But nobody has that button to push to make the 400 million guns in America disappear anytime soon. There's a different thing that we can do, which is try and address the violence part of this.
One strategy is simply to teach people. So, for example, there's this program for middle and high school boys called Becoming a Man. And basically what they do is help boys learn what are called social cognitive skills, how to, you know, regulate their emotions and de-escalate conflicts. And Jens and his colleagues have studied the Chicago branch of this program. And what they found was boys who went through it were less likely to be arrested for carrying guns and about 50% less likely to be arrested for a violent offense.
Which is a huge reduction.
Strategy two, help change people's environments. And this can be illustrated by a study Jens points to that included researchers from the University of Pennsylvania. Philadelphia, like many Rust Belt cities, has a lot of vacant abandoned lots. And they worked with the city to raise money and hold a lottery to choose which of these lots would be cleaned up and converted into pocket parks.
And the first thing that they could see is that people were way more likely to be out in public when scary vacant lot is turned into a charming little pocket park. So that's getting more people out and about so that they can basically serve as eyes on the street to help de-escalate things, right? And the second thing they can see in the police data is that there's a really big reduction in shootings around those areas. You know, depending on the neighborhood that you're looking at, these are like 10 to 30% reductions in shootings. And so the solutions are not what we thought. We can see that it's much more fixable. Let's see the problem for what it is and like, let's get going starting yesterday.
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Abby Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In Minneapolis, we've been hearing reflections about what it meant to people here when George Floyd was killed by a police officer 5 years ago, and the officers with him didn't stop him. We also asked attorney Benjamin Crump. He represented Floyd's family in a civil suit against the city, and as he says, in the court of public opinion.
It was a watershed moment, not just for America, but for people all across the world.
Why do you think that is? Do you have a theory about that? And I ask you as a person who's been involved in so many of these cases at this point, what do you think it is about George Floyd's death that sparked this kind of worldwide movement?
Well, Michelle, you and I first met during the Trayvon Martin case, where Trayvon Martin's killer was not held accountable. You look at all of the tragedies, Michael Brown and Ferguson, hands up, don't shoot. You look at Tamir Rice playing on the playground, being shot within 1.5 seconds of the police arriving there. Philando Castile, Sandra Bland, so many where there was no justice. And so when you get to George Floyd, it's almost a clarion call to everybody who felt like Trayvon could have been their son, that Sandra Bland could have been their daughter. Now you're seeing George Floyd, and you're saying, we must get justice.
Do you think that anything has substantively changed since George Floyd was killed?
I think we had many changes since George Floyd was killed. However, so many hashtags, Michelle Martin. So we must stay vigilant now more than ever, when it seems like the Department of Justice has abandoned us when it comes to fighting these cases.
Why do you say that?
Because with Breonna Taylor and many others, they said they're not going to prosecute the cases. They say they are abandoning anything, any policies or consent decrees by the Biden administration, Merrick Garland, and especially our sister Christian Clark, who was the first Black woman to be over the Civil Rights Division at DOJ.
You first became a national figure after Trayvon Martin was killed back in 2012. Since then, you've handled so many of these cases. I mean, on the one hand, you've had, you know, tremendous success in bringing some measure of peace to these families, but yet and still you keep getting these cases. And I wonder how you feel about that or how you think about that.
Yeah, Michelle, if every time they shoot a Black man in the back, we can make them pay $10, $20 million, hopefully that will stop them from killing us in such extraordinary, unbelievable ways. And even though we win every time in the civil court, it's the criminal courts that we can't control, only the elected officials can. And so we have to make sure we're electing prosecutors, legislators to make laws and make sure those laws are followed fairly and equally. It's about making sure that the words on the courtroom wall are not just rhetorical, but making them real.
What kind of conversation do you think we'll be having 5 years from now?
Well, I think it'll be a very similar conversation. We've been having this conversation for 400 years in America. So, like Frederick Douglass said, we can't get depressed because of the struggle. We have to celebrate the struggle, because without struggle, there could be no progress. And so as long as we're fighting, that means we're giving our children a better chance to have a better world. And that's what motivates me every day.
Ben Crump, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
I've been reporting all this week from Minneapolis, where George Floyd's life ended under a police officer's knee 5 years ago.
The outpouring of grief and protest over Floyd's murder inspired a choral work that premiered in 2022. It's called A Knee on the Neck.
Have you ever seen a knee on the neck? Have you ever seen a knee?
Here's what composer Adolphus Hailstork told us back then.
We're talking about the taking of a life
and then taking of many lives, and the general cultural attitudes we have.
The words were written by poet Herbert Martin days after Floyd was killed. Martin grew up in Alabama in the aftermath of the Great Depression, years before the peak of the civil rights movement.
And when we spoke with him again this week, he recalled the talk his mother gave him to avoid run-ins with police.
You must always mind your manners. Say yes or no, sir. She wanted to find me whole and not to have to rush me off to the hospital.
The advice is also heard in the Requiem Cantata.
Martin says he hasn't seen much positive change over the 5 years since Floyd's murder, and that, he says, is a concern.
I think it's going to get worse and worse.
And he adds, it's important to recall trauma to overcome it.
People tend to be very, very angry instantaneously, and then they forget why, and so one has to remind them of what brought us to that point of agitation, and then what brings us even beyond that to doing something about it.
Hale Storck injects hope into a composition that began with a solitary death.
A moment of universal outreach to hope that there'll be a greater sense of peace and respect among all the people of America.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News, with a special thanks this week to Jeff Jones and all of our colleagues at Minnesota Public Radio for their support and contributions to our reporting. I'm Michelle Martin.
I've got beginner's luck. The first time that I'm in love with you. Gosh, I'm lucky. I've got beginner's luck. They told me beginners win, now I know it's true. Gosh, I'm fortunate, this thing we've begun is much more than a pastime, for this time is the one where the first time is the last time. I've got beginner's luck, lucky through and through, 'cause the first time that I'm in love with you.